Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. Your Baltimore Orioles are now, I believe, 2-0 as we tape this. So things are good. Times are good.
My North Melbourne Kangaroos are 0-1. They had the worst defeat on opening weekend of all the Aussie Rules football teams. Despite their decent run in the playoffs last year, they start 2015 on a down note. But as you know, in all sports, opening day is not a
Yeah.
predictor of the rest of the year.
Not necessarily a harbinger of things to come. The Nats, your Washington Nationals, lost their opening game to the New York Mets. But of course, the Nats are expected to win 100 or more games this season. So again, it's they play 162 games. You don't win them all,
Are
but we're
both are
happy that
both,
spring is sort of here.
but is there hope for a Beltway series this year?
Yeah, there could be. We talked possible. It was definitely possible last year. It's possible again this year. I mean, there's so many variables, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I would love nothing more than for that to happen. I'm sure Major League Baseball would not prefer that. They would probably like to see the Yankees or somebody who might have better cable, not cable, but broadcast ratings. But I think it would be pretty neat if it happened. So rooting for that.
Now, can you take your kids to Camden Yards yet? Are they old enough to sit through a game?
No, they're not old enough. Not only are they not old enough to sit through a game, they're not old enough to watch a game. But, I have the Apple TV, and one of the apps is like a Major League Baseball app that takes every game and condenses it into about a 3-minute, here's what happened. And it just, this is a 3-minute version of the game. And my son and I, my older son, who's 4, watch the replays of the games every day. That's sort of as much as he could get. If we made it to Camden Yards, we would be it would last for about a half inning. I would probably spend about $500 on food and sort of accessories, and we would leave, I'm thinking, around the middle of the second or third inning. That's how it will go.
I've taken my girls to see the Holyoke Blue Sox in the New England Collegiate Baseball League, but that was because they have a bounce house there, and I put them in the bounce house, give them pizza and hot dogs, and I make it through the second inning, and then I leave, and I haven't really spent all that much money because
Yeah.
it's not a steep ticket, and the closest professional minor league team to me was or. Technically, currently is the New Britain Rock Cats, which is in Central Connecticut. But as of 2016, they're moving to Hartford into a glitzy new ballpark, and they'll be rechristened the Hartford Yard Goats. That was just announced a couple of weeks ago. There was a fan contest to name the team, and Yard Goat is actually an old rail term, but I think they're excited by the marketing possibilities of having lots of goats on merchandise and trying to attract kids to the games
Oh
with
yeah,
that.
minor league baseball is great. It's arguably more fun to go to, and it's certainly more fun to take kids to than big league baseball. Hey, while we're promoting kids stuff, I want to throw something out there, Bill. There's a show called Liberty's Kids that I discovered, and because my kids love TV, I try to get them to go out to the play outside. They prefer to watch TV. And what they really want to watch is like violent superhero shows, which even these cartoons are still for literally a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old are incredibly violent. So I started searching around, like, because Mount Vernon's near our house, we go to Mount Vernon. How can I get them into history? And it turns out there's this cartoon series called Liberty's Kids, and it's voiced by like Ben Stiller, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Dustin Hoffman. Walter Cronkite is Ben Franklin, and I expected it to be super, super cheesy. It turns out it's super interesting, and I'm learning stuff. And I bought it on iTunes. You can see it on YouTube if you want, but it's like a 40-part series. It's amazingly good, and my kids love it, and we watch it together. But I did have an interesting incident with my son, who's named after Edmund Burke, who was a member of Parliament. But now he's watching these shows, and he's really come to hate the Redcoats and the Brits. And he told my wife, because my son goes to preschool, he says, my friend Desmond over spring break, he goes, my friend Desmond's going to see his Nana back in England, where the bad people live. So apparently he now hates the British, but at least he is learning about Abraham Lincoln and loves George Washington. And there's stuff that I learned about Bill, and it's super interesting. Let me throw this one out. I'm going to see if I can find this lady's name. Have you heard of a woman named Sybil Ludington?
No.
Nobody's heard of her, okay? On Liberty's Kids, there's an entire episode dedicated to her.
Oh.
In 1777, she was a 16-year-old girl who made a midnight ride in April 26, 1777 to call out Colonel Ludington's regiment to repel British at Danbury, Connecticut. So this girl rode twice as far as Paul Revere in a rainstorm, and nobody knows who she is. There's a statue to her, I think, in New York or something, and there's a whole episode about her. These are the things that I'm learning about. It's just amazing. Paul Revere, apparently there was another guy who went on the ride the same night Paul Revere did, who just didn't have as good of a PR agent or something. But so now my kids are learning about history. I've got them off some of the violent cartoons. Side effect is they really do hate British people and Hessians. To be honest, they're not too keen on Hessians either. But I'm learning stuff.
I will check that out. I've introduced them to the presidents via two different presidential pets books. Which is very successful. My older daughter actually said a lot of presidents' names and what pets they owned through that. But I think perhaps your avenue might be a little more education for the long term. I'm just guessing.
Well, I think the pet thing is great too. We have these little books too. I've got one about George and Orville Wright. I've got one about Martin Luther King Jr. I've got a few of them that are historic that you read the kids about. These little stories. I mean, I really want to try to, as a parent, you really to compete with the dominant culture and what people are selling them. And as I wrote recently, I think conservatives should be as worried about big business, what they're selling your kids, as we are about big government. And you have to be very diligent in trying to expose your kids, because you're not going to get them off TV unless you're going to move out to like Montana and homeschool and like completely go off the grid. So it's a matter of finding, and that's a great thing about technology. It's a double-edged sword, but I was able to find this Liberty's Kids show. And I know it sounds so lame and cheesy, amazingly good. And let's just do a daddy show sometime. But
Father's Day's coming up.
There you go. I'm going to recommend that for all of our viewers, and I know literally dozens of you out there. So go check it out.
Well, you mentioned we were going to talk about this today, but you did wrote a very important piece for the Daily Beast, mostly because you mentioned me. That made it very important to me. talking about how conservatives should not treat big business like their natural allies. This is coming off the heels of the divisions that were exposed with the Indiana and the Arkansas religious freedom bills that business interests fought against, worried that they would lead to state boycotts and hurt their bottom lines. And social conservatives were bruised, saying, these guys are not acting like our friends. Why must we be under the same big tent as them? We don't share interests. And you seem to further that line of reasoning in your piece, and with a little dig at me from my old piece about how liberal advancements happen when they get corporate acquiescence, that piece I wrote for the Times back in 2012.
Well, not a dig at you. I say a complimentary. You were, number one, you were in the lead. Number two, I think you were totally right. That piece you wrote for the New York Times, where liberals win when they, to use a pejorative phrasing, co-opt big business. I mean, that's when they win. And I think if you look at this...
And that's when you win, too.
and if you look at RFRA, liberals win when they co-opt big business, right? I mean, if it's not for Walmart and other big companies, but let's just take Walmart as a prime example, an organization that is ostensibly a red state conservative company, although we know the truth, they were on the side of, you know, of saying that the Arkansas and Indiana bill were bigotry, not religious liberty defenses, and they ended up winning. They ended up getting the bill essentially rewritten, and I think most conservatives would say that the fix was worse than doing nothing, or at least a lot of them would say that. So it does matter, and so there's a good reason to align with big business, because for whatever reason they tend to win more often than not. Look, I think it's interesting. We've had conservatives for a long time arguing that big business is not necessarily friends with conservatives. You've had people like Tim Carney point out the fact that big business is perfectly fine with having onerous regulations that only they can comply with, because that stifles competition. The little guy can't afford to hire enough lawyers and accountants to comply with regulation. Big business is more than happy to do that. There's examples where people who care about human rights and foreign policy, human rights issues, don't like the fact that big business more than happy to do business in with China or Iran or whomever, as long as it helps their profit margin. And by the way, let's look at Apple as a company, more than happy to do business with people who have atrocious track record on human rights, including with gays in their own country. And so there's a lot of examples of this. And I think what happened in Indiana is just the most recent example of why social conservatives specifically should not automatically assume that big business is on their side. And I go on to say, forget about what happened in Indiana and Arkansas and about how big business essentially, you know, sold them out and on their desire to protect religious liberty. But look at what big business sells us, right? So like, if you are a dad like the two of us are, and you want to try to raise your kids, who is more likely to be selling them violence or, you know, promiscuous sexual images on TV, or trying to get them to eat crappy food that's horrible for them? Basically, if you want to keep your kids from like becoming horrible people, the biggest danger you have is keeping them away from big business who wants to sell them horrible ideas, products, and values. It's not big government. I mean, you know, I think they're out to get you too, but so is big business. Like, they're trying. I tell my kid, my son, my oldest boy, like, for, number one, we mostly watch videos on Netflix or iTunes that I essentially pay for through a service or by buying them that are commercial free. Now, those have their own product placement, don't get me wrong, but we don't watch commercials. Well, once in a while, the mother-in-law lets them watch TV and commercials come on. And what I say is, these people are trying to sell you something. They do not necessarily have your best interest at heart. I think it's really important for people to know that these are not necessarily good people who want you to buy things. And the things that you're buying could be ideas or they could be actual products. But anyway, that is my rant, and I think now you could say that there's a broad spectrum of conservatives who need to be concerned about big business. Not just, I think primarily it was focused on the sort of fiscal conservative issue before. Now I think we can say, look, if you want to temporarily align with big business on a short-term basis to pass something just like the left did recently, that's fine, go for it. But these people are not your friends. It is not a natural alliance. And guess what? The next time the unions come gunning for Walmart, don't help them unless you want to. Like, unless it's in your best interest to help them, but don't feel compelled to take a bullet for them or to go to war for them, because they're not your friend. That was essentially my point.
And I think that's a point that, I mean, it's a different question on the left, because the left is sort of predisposed to not looking at big business as their friends. And even the piece that I wrote, I'm not saying that they are your friends, you know, today, tomorrow, and forever. Right. It's just that you need to, you know, enter into bargains at critical junctures if you want to get your goals advanced, understanding that they're not to be trusted. They're to be bargained with and to find hard-fought common ground, knowing full well they probably won't have your back the next day.
No, you're right, Bill. And this is say, I think you were exactly right. That's a brilliant piece you wrote in the New York Times. If you haven't read it, I think it's called How Liberals Win. Everybody should go back and read it. It's about 3 years old. You were exactly right. I do think, however, that conservatives have wrongly believed that business and even big business is on our side. And so for you, this is like a no-brainer. For I think what I'm telling people is, to a certain degree, a shock to them. It is actually kind of a profound notion that whether you're a foreign policy conservative, a social conservative, or a fiscal conservative, big business is not your friend.
Well, now we have a new presidential candidate throwing his hat in the ring, Rand Paul, who I think has fans perhaps in the between the Koch brothers, but not necessarily beloved amongst a lot of corporate America, precisely because he goes after things like the Ex-Im Bank, and he wants to abolish the entire Commerce Department. So he is touting himself as a liberty lover, and is trying to piece together a coalition that would go against what a lot of folks in the Republican establishment and the corporate boardrooms want. He made some nods to social conservatism in his announcement, not as forcefully as Ted Cruz did. Ted Cruz seemed to be very overtly saying, let's fuse Tea Party with social conservatism. I'm going to profess my love for Jesus Christ. I'm going to speak at Liberty University. Rand didn't go quite that far. But you being a very astute observer of the different strains of the conservative movement, which of the two has got the lead in putting together a working coalition that could, you know, get over the Jeb Bush hump? Or is the mere fact that they're both in the race and more are coming make it impossible for that coalition to be built because they're going to divvy up the conservative base too much?
Well, first, I always begin with the preface that we don't know. Nobody knows. And anybody who tells you they know what's going to happen is lying to you. However, I've been studying, you know, the conservative movement and especially Republican primaries for a long time. And I just tell you my gut. And my gut is that Ted Cruz wins this contest. I mean, eventually it has to come. I mean, assuming Rand and Cruz both stay in the race and both do well, at some point it becomes a zero-sum game. I mean, they will face off. And I think Ted Cruz wins that fight, I think, for a variety of reasons. I think that number one, Rand is attempting to hold together this kind of, I think, is an untenable coalition of, you know, trying to sort of start off with his dad's base, keep them all happy, but then expand into other territory and bring in new people. I think that's ultimately untenable. He's tried to do it, but it's forced him to be very flexible, to be in some cases to flip-flop. I think that ultimately catches up with him. I think the political, if the foreign policy zeitgeist has really gone against him. There's a time a few years ago when he seemed to be in the right man at the right time. Russia invades Crimea. You've got the rise of ISIS. All of a sudden now, Rand's, you know, non-interventionist foreign policy doesn't look quite so good, especially when you compare it to, you know, essentially, I think the big problem is Ted Cruz. I mean, Ted Cruz is like what you like about Rand Paul, except better and more mainstream, more of a mainstream conservative, just a better version of Rand Paul. He's a better speaker. And, you know, look, don't get me wrong. There are some hardcore libertarians who would prefer Rand. But by the way, they're not ecstatic with him either, because he has moved away from being, you know, a pure libertarian. There is a market for Rand, but I think by and large, I think that Ted Cruz outmaneuvers Rand ultimately. I think he raises more money. I think he's a better speaker than Rand. I think he's got most of what, if you're a grassroots conservative Tea Party type, he's got most of what Rand offers and just does a better job of it. So ultimately,
Cruz has also had a much smoother rollout. For that first week, I mean, Rand's first 24 hours has been pretty rough, and he seems to. I mean, I think Rick Santorum had this problem too. He just likes to talk so much and do as many interviews as possible, and he gets himself in a lot of scrapes. One of Rand's first interviews in the Senate race was the infamous interview with Rachel Maddow when he questioned the 1964 Civil Rights Act and has had to live that down ever since. Now he's had a couple of run-ins with women reporters where he shushed one several months ago. Now on the Today Show, he was seemingly condescending to Savannah Guthrie when being challenged about some of his flip-flops. And then he got dressed down by Megyn Kelly on Fox News last night, too, on the same as she asked him about this pattern of behavior. This only seems to augment your point that he's just not as strong a presidential candidate as Ted Cruz and others may be.
Yeah, well, he's not. And I mean, everybody jokes about the idea of sitting around in dorm rooms and engaging in esoteric debates about libertarian philosophy and Mises and Austrian economics. That's what Rand Paul does. That's him. And then you've got Ted Cruz, who is number one, a master debater. He's a very good debater. And he's also the son of a preacher man. and so intellectually in a debate, like on a television appearance, he stays on script. Cruz essentially memorizes his shtick. I mean, the guy memorized the Constitution or parts of it. He essentially knows what he's going to say. He recites his talking points. He's disciplined. He stays on message. I don't think he engages and takes the bait that Rand Paul simply can't resist. And then when it comes to actually giving a speech, to delivering a speech, Rand Paul is better than his father, Ron, but Ted Cruz is better than his father, who was a preacher. And when you look at places, he rolls out his campaign at Liberty. Ted Cruz does Liberty University, essentially delivers what a lot of people. Now, by the way, I am an evangelical, so I don't pick up on this. In fact, if you saw the live stream of the Liberty University Ted Cruz announcement, there was like music. There was like a band playing. I knew like 90%. I have like 90% of the songs that were played before I have on my iPhone. You know what I mean? So like. But I'm told by people who are unfamiliar with that world that that it came across to them as like an evangelical preacher, which is probably a good thing if you're going to Iowa, right? So, yeah, it's a long way of saying I think that Cruz is a better communicator, more disciplined, and also more exciting. Like actually both things, more disciplined and more exciting. Usually you have one or the other. In Cruz's case, I just think he's a better version of Rand. And you just wonder what would have happened if, Rand Paul's elected, I think, in 2010, if the political environment had stayed the same and if Ted Cruz hadn't come along and Rand kind of had this lane more to himself, what might have been. But I think that there are just too many challenges for Rand to overcome, and the biggest one being Ted Cruz.
Now, one of the various scuffles he had the past 24 hours involved abortion. He told he was asked by the Associated Press, trying to pin him down on whether he supports exceptions to anti-abortion legislation or not. I think the night earlier he told Sean Hannity, "I support legislation with exceptions and support legislation without exceptions," which struck me as a very sort of John Kerry 2004. I voted for it before I was against it sort of answer. And then the Associated Press pressed him on it, and Rand gave a very convoluted thing, and he kind of admonished the EP. "I gave you a five-man answer. Put down the five-man answer." Then he's asked in front of cameras by a reporter. I'm not sure who the reporter was, but it was a woman reporter, for what it's worth. And then Rand wouldn't answer directly and say, "Why don't you ever ask Debbie Wasserman Schultz if she wants to kill a seven-month-old fetus in the womb? If you get an answer from her, then come back to me." And you like that. You liked him, turning the tables and talking smack to the reporter, even though, as I said to you on Twitter, that just struck me as a classic dodge on not answering the question. But you thought it was a heartening sign on his part.
Yeah. Well, let me say, I had already dinged Rand Paul earlier that day for dodging Savannah Guthrie's questions. In fact, if you go to the Daily Caller, I wrote, I think the piece is titled "Savannah Guthrie Was Right" or "Savannah Guthrie Was Just Doing Her Job." I think that's what I titled it. And in that interview, she was bringing up his flip-flops on things like Iran, things that she was bringing up things he had said in the past. And Rand interrupted her very dismissively, accused her of editorializing, and then proceeded to lecture her on how to ask questions, which I found to be incredibly patronizing. Now, from an optics standpoint, it doesn't look good. Some people think that there's like a misogyny thing there, but I don't even get into that. You know, whether she was a female or a male reporter, it was him. She was doing her job and he was dodging the question and then I think being insulting by doing it. So I had dinged Rand for dodging something just literally the same day this came up. In this instance, I think clearly a candidate running for president at some point has to have a coherent answer to serious questions about abortion. So I'm not excusing dodging that question. However, I think that he's entirely right about the framing of it. I think so substantively, I think he's right that conservatives in recent years, for whatever reason, are asked very specific questions about very rare instances having to do with, you know, rape and abortion and whatnot. And they're really, these are wedge questions that are put on the spot. And the same is not asked of liberal Democrats who support abortion. Like, when does life begin? You know, 20 weeks, you know, have you seen a 20-week, you know, baby? Those kind of questions. So I think Rand is substantively right. I think politically it was also very astute. Sometimes I think when you push back at reporters, it looks defensive, it looks weak, it looks like you're dodging. Other times I think people applaud. Remember Newt Gingrich, when he went after John King at that CNN debate, I think he got a lot of props. I forget who it was. It might have been Newt Gingrich who also went after, I'm trying to think of who it was. There was a Fox debate. Juan Williams, I think, asked a question about race, and it might have been Newt who went after him. So I think sometimes when you go after the press, especially if you question the premise of their questions, you actually can score political points. So I actually think Rand benefits from that interaction. I do not think he benefits from the Savannah Guthrie interaction, so it's kind of a wash.
I mean, it seems like the attack the media strategy, you know, will get you a degree of applause on the right, but at some point, I feel like there's a shift in thinking, even among conservatives, when it comes to presidential politics, where people start to say, well, if that's how the liberal media is going to treat this person, I don't think that person's going to win. It's fun. It's fun to watch them, you know, call these people out. But if it means they're just going to be hammered mercilessly throughout the general election and they're going to lose, then it's not really worth it. Mitt Romney and John McCain, you know, they didn't cut their teeth by doing a lot of media browbeating. So I don't see that as a long-term a useful strategy for a presidential nominee trying to actually win the whole thing.
I hear what you're saying, Bill. It's like pornography. You know it when you see it. I think sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think that, you know, again, when Newt did it, it worked. It's the way you do it. It's how you do it. It's very much in the execution. And I do think that there's a hunger amongst conservatives for politicians to challenge the premise of questions and to display, to sort of demonstrate hypocrisy and the framing of an issue. In this case, I think in recent years, the way that abortion's been framed has been very, the question has been framed in a very unflattering way to Republicans. Now, this was a reversal. I mean, there was a time when everybody was talking about partial birth abortion and late-term abortion, and Republicans were very much had the wind at their back as long as Democrats had to sort of, you know, hand-wring and answer questions about partial birth abortion. We've seen a big reversal of that in recent years. And I think that Rand, in the case of Savannah Guthrie, he mishandled it. I think in that case, pushing back at the media didn't work. It was flawed. It was poorly executed. However, I think in the case this time, now maybe he'll say something later today that'll contradict it, But I think that pushing back at this AP question, I think actually worked, and I don't think it hurts him at all. I think it helps him.
And now another issue that I think Rand is having a very tough time with is Iran, trying to balance the traditional Ron Paul anti-war supporters, anti-interventionist supporters, while trying to acknowledge that the current zeitgeist on the right is back to hawkishness, going after Iran, going after ISIS. Rand seems to be trying to, there was a neocon attack ad that came out in the day of his announcement, bringing up a comment he made on the Alex Jones radio show back in 2007, that Iran is not a security threat. It's ridiculous that they're a security threat to us, which Rand is now trying to slough off as, oh, that was 2007. I was campaigning for my dad. Things have changed then. Now things are totally different.
That was a long time ago.
Like, Iran is so much worse today than they were in 2007. It's a sea change.
Right.
And so he's trying to say that Iran is worse today than before, but he still supports negotiations over war. He wants there to be a deal. He thinks Congress should be able to approve the deal. He thinks Obama's deal is no good, but the attacks are from these awful neoconservatives who've been wrong all the time. He's literally said all those things in the past 24, 48 hours.
Why I say it's untenable, Bill. That's why I say it's untenable. I don't think Rand has to try to be all things to all people. He has to thread this needle perfectly. I don't think he can do it. I just think it's fraught with danger. He's going to continue. You know, when you have to be perfect all the time and you have to, frankly, mislead people, you're going to slip up. I just don't think you can make it. You know, it's a house of cards. I don't think it works.
Now, if I can stick with Iran and go and move to the Democratic side of things, I wrote a piece for Real Clear Politics that tried to explain, you know, how fervent support on the left is for this. I just don't feel like people have, maybe people assume it, but there's been so much talk about Senate Democrats, you know, being skeptical of the deal and possibly joining Republicans in scuttling the deal. I tried to explain how I find that very politically implausible, because this is not just a run-of-the-mill issue for the left. This is arguably the issue that propelled Obama to the Democratic nomination in the first place. I mean, we talk a lot about how, you know, if Hillary Clinton didn't vote for the Iraq War, maybe she wouldn't have lost that contest. And Obama's 2002 speech calling Iraq a dumb war was his calling card. But we have maybe not taken or remembered as well the exchange in 2007, July 2007, out the CNN YouTube debate where Obama was asked point blank by a YouTube member, would you meet with the leaders of Iran, Venezuela, Syria, North Korea yourself in the first year of your presidency? And Obama says without hesitation, I would.
Without
preconditions. He didn't wishy-washy. He said, I would. And he gave his reasons why we shouldn't be afraid to talk to people that we disagree with. And then the commenter asked for a follow-up from Hillary. And she said, I won't make that pledge. I'm not going to reward these countries. You know, lower level outreach, fine. But you don't do a presidential level visit without preconditions, without understanding what their intentions are. And the Clinton folks thought this was their opportunity to paint Obama as naive. But as David Plouffe had written about in his book, Audacity to Win, all of their focus group data and anecdotal information was that this was a crystallizing moment on the ground, especially in Iowa, where Democrat voters said, you know, there's a real difference here in support for direct diplomacy, and Obama's on the right side of this, Hillary is on the wrong side of it. Some have said since, well, Obama didn't do those visits in his first year. He did do lower level diplomatic outreach, so it really wasn't a real substantive difference. And even some dismay on the left that we haven't seen.
The other thing, as I recall, the other thing he said was that he would go into Pakistan and get bin Laden
Well, that's a different question. That's when they did do.
But and that was supposedly, I think that might have been against McCain. That might have been in the general. I don't remember.
No, but Hillary, Hillary and Chris Dodd and Joe Biden opposed him on that point in the debates. And they also tried to paint him as naive. That was part of their naive argument.
Right.
And,
yeah, that was potentially a liability at the time. Right.
And I think all that combined, and that's where the I think it is a very, I didn't talk about it in my most recent column. I've talked about it in the past. I mean, that was a key element that prevented Obama from being seen as, you know, a pure pacifist. So it rounded out the anti-war positions that he was offering. Say, I'm going to target the actual threats, but I'm going to do very robust direct diplomacy otherwise. So all that combined, I thought was very reassuring to those, I mean, there's a reason why Dennis Kucinich is not the nominee. Like, just being anti-war is not enough. And he was able to go at Hillary, et cetera, and say, you guys are getting it wrong across the board. I'm not the naive one here. You guys went into Iraq and you won't go after bin Laden. Who's the naive one here? So all that worked to Obama's favor in the primary. And even if he didn't do exactly that in the first year, and there's some disconcertion on the left that there hasn't been enough diplomacy. Some people don't like the drones and don't like some of the militaristic aspects of the Obama foreign policy. This is the payoff. This was worth the wait. If it's true that just being Obama did not make the world a better place on the day he was sworn in, that the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009 was woefully premature, this is evidence of the value of patient and creative direct diplomacy. Even if it takes a long time, if there's a lot of setbacks, if there's lots of reasons not to be confident that's going to work out, this validates that initial belief that liberal Democrat voters had in Obama. And that can now be held up as an example, assuming it all pans out, you know, a few months later. Obviously, it's not all the T's are crossed yet. But it's a way to say, you know, yes, direct diplomacy does work. Don't be a naysayer. Don't dismiss it even when things don't go right initially. So for Senate Democrats, there are about as many as 15 who have flirted with joining Republicans and trying to scuttle the deal. And they probably need 13 or 14 to have a veto-proof majority in the Senate. And the House is another story, but the Senate is probably where this battle first gets waged. For those to actually follow through and actually scuttle the deal, which is now seen on the left as the capstone of Obama's foreign policy legacy, a potential game changer for the reason, the fundamental reason why we wanted this guy to be president in the first place, to do that, you got to have a lot of things going for you. You need to have very clear public opinion on your side, nationally, in your state, some division in the Democratic base. You don't have that today, not by a long shot. So I wrote on Monday that I thought this was very politically unrealistic for Democrats. I mean, if you believe it in your heart and you're willing to lose your seat over it, fine. I don't think those guys want to take it that far.
Never mind lose your seat. Potentially, you could go to jail, like, you know, a certain senator who happened to have a scandal erupt.
Hey, I know a certain publication that was agitating for that indictment for a long time. So I don't even know the Daily Caller should be upset about that guy's indictment.
Well, now I think it's pretty clear the guy's been set up, though, don't you?
I think we have an independent Department of Justice that is merely doing its job. And the fact that Bob Menendez is no longer the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee does have an impact on this debate. You know, he was probably the biggest antagonist to Obama. He stepped down from that position. It's now Ben Cardin. And Ben Cardin is saying, I don't want to do anything that's going to weaken the president. You have several other Democrats who were flirting with it before, who are now talking openly about modifying the Corker bill, making it amenable to the White House, making clear that's not going to upset negotiations. At every point of this debate, even Menendez, when they had the opportunity to put a bill on the floor before the deal was done and undermine it, truncate it, they backed off. They know deep down this is not a tenable position for a Democrat, particularly in a blue state. Maybe Joe Manchin or Heidi Heitkamp can do it, but all 13 or 14 of them, many of those people are from, you know, Northeast states or Florida. You know, some people say these guys are pandering to Likud supporters who are donors in their states. That may well be, but those folks can't dictate their final vote. There's broader Democratic constituencies that they have to answer to. And I think you've seen over this week, they're pulling back from that belligerent position. I imagine it's going to stay that way.
Well, I think you're right. And I think it's pretty clear that you're right, just based on the evidence. So
what does that mean for the Republican side, though? I mean, is this going to be a flashpoint on the Republican side where they try to outdo how anti-Iran, anti-deal they can be?
Yeah. Well, this is just one more example of how one more example of how partisanship is now complete, you know, where it's going to line up by, you know, according to party lines, ultimately, at least to the degree of people who have political aspirations for higher office. So I think that's how it shakes out, and that's consistent with almost everything else nowadays.
Sorry, go on. Your phone's cutting out a little bit, so I can't hear you so well.
Oh, I'm sorry. When push comes to shove, people tend to go to their respective corners, and it seems like that's how this is going to end up.
I mean, it seems like on the Republican side, I assume there's a very deep belief this is not going to work, that this is truly horrible. This is going to lead to the Iranians having a nuclear bomb, and all sorts of bad things will ensue after that. But is there any thought? I mean, what if it does work? You know, I mean, let's say they do the deal. Obama survives congressional opposition. It's in place for at least the year and a half left on Obama's watch. What does that mean for the Republican foreign policy outlook or Bibi Netanyahu's outlook? You say all these horrible things are going to happen if the deal was done. It gets done, at least initially, the Iranians follow the deal. Would that force any kind of rethinking about Republican foreign policy if we have an example of a direct diplomacy action that actually paid off in the end?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is it's very difficult to demonstrate that it really worked. And in other words, you could always say, no, Obama got hoodwinked, and the minute that they want to go nuclear, they can. So how it's sort of like proving a negative. I mean, first of all, I think that this is a gut issue. Nobody knows how many centrifuges or, you know, the details. It's like, do you trust President Obama as a negotiator to negotiate from strength? And do you trust Iran to negotiate honestly and to honor their commitment? And I think most people, and certainly almost all Republicans, would answer no to both of those questions. So it feels implausible that this would be a good deal. And, you know, it's hard to say, like, what would happen that would actually be solid evidence that this was a good deal, that somebody who just has their mind set against it would have to eat their words, would have to concede that this diplomacy worked. It would be, in my opinion, it would be very difficult. And by the time that happened, we'd be on this many, many other issues. So I think there's very low risk. This is low risk, high reward if you're a Republican for opposing it. Number one, I think it's likely that Iran is going to kind of go nuclear eventually. That they're going to like cheat and lie here. But either way, you're never going to be held accountable. No one's ever going to, you know, point back and say, yes, Tom Cotton, but you were wrong about that. I think it's low risk, high reward if you're a Republican to be very hawkish on this issue.
All right. Well, do you agree
with that?
I mostly agree with that. I think there's huge risk for Netanyahu here. I think Netanyahu has put so much on the line to say the Iranians are out to get us. And, I mean, it's basically the lone issue that saved him in his job. But he still presides over a fairly weak coalition, maybe a little less weak than it was before, but it's still, right. He still doesn't have control majority of the Knesset. So if you're 2 years into an Iranian deal and hell hasn't ensued, what's your argument then to keep that job?
Well, yeah, and sometimes people lose their victims of success, right? Winston Churchill gets turned out after winning World War II. I mean, my point here is you could spin this, and don't get me wrong, this would be pure and utter spin, but you could spin this to say, because we were so opposed to Iran and to this deal, that forced Obama to cut a better deal. Now, that sounds like baloney to me.
I don't think it's baloney at all. I think they could be playing. I mean, I don't think they are necessarily, but I think Obama has used that belligerence to his advantage, and that's why I don't agree with the notion that he's not negotiating from strength. I mean, I think this is a combination of use of very aggressive sanctions in the first term, and using the prospect of belligerent Republicans and Netanyahu to say, "Look, if you guys don't deal with me, you know, you're thrown to the wolves with them. So good luck to you."
Yeah,
I totally think that's been working.
Well, to me, I think the bigger danger, like right now, as I said, right now, I think it's like essentially no risk. But I do think the one potential risk was if the deal had fallen apart, Republicans could have been blamed for helping scuttle it because of the Cotton letter, and that would have maybe had some political downside. And by the way, it is, you know, I do realize we're talking about like political ramifications about an issue that's like way more substantive, and whether or not Iran goes nuclear is much more important than whether or not like Tom Cotton gets blamed for scuttling a deal, right? For the political side of it. But look, that's what we do. We talk about politics. We make no excuses for doing that, or maybe just the little excuse I just made. But now that the deal, essentially the framework, at least it looks like this is happening, I think there's no harm if you're a Republican for being completely against this.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no short-term political risk today, and people forget what people's positions took, you know, days later. There's probably no risk for an individual Republican politician. I think there may be a risk for the neoconservative movement, maybe a risk for a Bill Kristol, for example, where, you know, people have already said, you guys already got it wrong with Iraq. If 2-3 years down the road, people say, and you got it wrong with Iran too, you know, really, why are you have any role of influence
but
in
nobody,
this party anymore?
But if Iran, here's the deal though, like when they got it wrong with Iraq, you can point to a, you know, dead soldiers and a failed country. If they get it wrong about Iran, hey, they were just playing it safe. They were, you know, there's very little liability for sort of overestimating how evil and devious Iran is. So I don't think it ever would really hurt them. By the way, let me say this, going back to the Rand Paul Iran thing we were talking about earlier. This sort of goes back to the business. Remember I was talking about how big business is trying to screw you, just like big government is? Like, that's my mantra. My take is that the neocons, I don't think they've learned anything from Iraq. Like, I think we have to watch them. But I also think Rand Paul, if you were to put him on sodium pentothal and he were to tell you the truth, I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and there's one called Tom Wood's Show, and this is a guy who's a libertarian, super interesting guy, lots of ideas that I don't agree with, but I sort of have a sense for what libertarians believe, like the Rand Paulites believe, the Ron Paulites believe. They believe in their heart of hearts that Iran are rational actors. That these are people who they're just like us. They're like any other country, and yeah, they want to defend themselves, but they're not crazy religious zealots. Sometimes they have to pander to their base, but I mean, that's what Rand Paul, I think, in his heart of hearts, believes. He has to play hawkish. So my point of saying this is, when I sort of consume foreign policy information, if it's coming from the quote unquote neocons, I take it a little bit with a grain of salt, thinking, you know, they'd bomb anybody tomorrow, you know? And if I hear it from Rand Paul, I sort of take it thinking, this guy's a little bit naive. He thinks that Iran, you know, well, what are they, let them have the bomb. Everybody, you know, what's the big deal? They're not going to do any harm. I mean, I'm sort of in the middle of these two groups, and I think that's the space that Ted Cruz is actually trying to occupy, whether he believes it or not, or whether that's just like a good space to be at. And I think as consumers, I mean, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a foreign policy expert, but I think we need to be like very skeptical of what people are telling us. And the people who told us that we would be greeted as liberators, let's maybe question them when they say things like, we can easily take out this reactor. No, there won't be any repercussions, no problems, right?
You think Kotick's comments along those lines this week were strange?
I don't know if he's right or wrong. I mean, the guy knows more about, he's a combat veteran, knows more than I do. But from a political standpoint, it struck me as a little bit too greeted as liberators, you know, a little bit too easy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I do think that the libertarian Rand Paul non-interventionists, I won't call them isolationists because they love free trade and they're free marketers, but I think that they have a naive view of other countries that do want to kill us and are religious zealots in many cases, and in some cases are evil. And I think they see them as just like very much like us, very much rational actors. They just, you know, they're acting in their self-interest. We're acting in our self-interest. And I think you have to be skeptical of both sides here. And whether you're a conservative or not, do not believe what the so-called experts tell you. You got to check this stuff out and be skeptical of everybody.
I will give you the last word, sir, in true DMZ style.
Well, I have to rush off.
Okay.
Now, Bill, let's just address very quickly. You know, yes. You don't have to go into any details or anything here, but last episode you did leave abruptly.
Oh yes.
And you're okay.
Yes.
And
we
are not upset with each other.
No. No. I had one of my daughters had to do a quick run to the hospital, but it was okay. There was nothing to stress about. He's back. She's home that same day, and all is fine.
You made the right call. Family first. You're a good dad and a good DMZ partner. And thank you, everybody, for watching us. Check us out on Twitter, /DMZ show, and on Facebook, same thing. So another award-winning episode, Bill.
I agree. I'll see you next week.
All right. See you guys. Thanks.